And please turn your Bibles to the book of Revelation, chapter 21. And if you haven't already signed in to that little welcome pad that is on your pew, please do so. We'd love to know that you're here, and especially if you're visiting for the first time. Book of Revelation, chapter 21. And then a few verses from chapter 22 as well. Listen now to the inspired, infallible Word of God. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Now the dwelling of God is with men. He will live with them. They will be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no longer any more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain. For the old order of things has passed away." And he was sitting on the throne, said, "I am making everything new." And he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." And then chapter 22, "Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. The leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be any curse. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will serve him there. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads." We have come now to the climax of our study from the Apostles' Creed. The Apostles' Creed ends with this resounding culmination: "I believe in the resurrection of the body and life everlasting. Amen." We have been considering portions of the Gospel of John as illustrations of various language statements or phrases out of the Apostles' Creed. But for this morning and this last study of this series, I'll be going to another book by the Apostle John, the last book of the New Testament, the Revelation of Jesus Christ, where John gives us a Christian understanding of the end of history. As I've been preparing for our next series that will start right after this one, which will be a series on themes from the book of Genesis, you'll notice that the end of history begins in the beginning of history. Genesis begins in a garden and the tree of life, and ends in a city and the tree of life. In Genesis, God is sitting on his throne on the seventh day, celebrating all of the creation, the heavens and the earth. And here at the end of the book of Revelation, God is sitting on the throne celebrating the creation of the new heavens and the new earth. The end started way back in the very beginning. Well, today we'll conclude this study on this ancient creed by considering these last two chapters from the Apocalypse, as it's called, in apocalyptic literature, the book of Revelation. Now, I use the word on purpose, apocalyptic, because it is a kind of literature. Apocalyptic literature is different than mere poetry. For in conventional poetry, you'll find the author using metaphorical language, but then developing that metaphor throughout the course of his poem. So, for example, The most famous of all poems, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," is really a poem or a song about this image of the shepherd ministry of the Lord toward his people. And the rest of the psalm then, in many ways, fleshes out that metaphor. But in apocalyptic literature, you have a number of metaphors compressed and really kind of overlapping and falling all over themselves. You have, for example, a city wearing a dress. You have a lamb sitting on a throne. In apocalyptic literature, the seer, the visionary, the prophet is seeing things that are so rich that it bursts the boundaries of conventional categories. It is so rich and overflowing that the writer and his language is almost mythical. So the trouble of preaching one sermon on these verses is the density, even of the verses that I read, merely 9 verses, which would easily lend itself to a number of sermons just to flesh out each of these metaphors. Although we're not going to have that, we're going to have just one here. We'll try and get through what we read in a few minutes. This passage teaches that there's a hope, a living hope. Today we're celebrating the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and that is the hope of all hopes for us. This passage is going to talk about what that hope is to mean, how that hope is to enable us, that if we bring this hope into the center of our lives, it will enable us to endure and to sustain any calamity that may be facing us. Is that what you're facing today? A calamity? A trial? To call it a trial is a colossal understatement. I'm sure many of you are, and I don't even know you. I'm sure that's the case. Each of us is facing something that might be way over our heads, and you need hope. Well, this morning I want to give you hope, not because I have anything to say out of myself, but because this passage right out of the Bible has been used to give hope to Christians for generations, for centuries. And I commend this to you this morning. First of all, let me observe that we need such a living hope. If you're following along in an outline, filling in the blanks, let me say that you need a living hope. But why was this book written in the first place, and to whom was it written? What were these first century readers facing when John wrote this book to them? Well, Emperor Domitian, who was one of the Roman emperors in the latter part of the first century, he began his rule in 81 AD and was the first Roman emperor to begin the systematic persecution of Christians. You have a hint at it here in verse 4 of chapter 21, where he says, "He will wipe away every tear. There'll be no more death or mourning or crying or pain." What these Christians were about to face under the reign of Domitian would be more death, more mourning, more crying, more pain than anyone here could possibly imagine. See, how you handle your present is completely determined by what you believe your future to be. How you handle the things that you're enduring right now has everything to do with what you believe your future is going to be. Let me give you an example. Two people have the same job. Each of them works 80 hours a week. Very, very boring, monotonous work. There are no vacations on the horizon. Each person you work with and work for is a complete idiot. The first person is promised at the end of the year, you'll be paid $15,000. The second person, at the end of the year, you are going to be paid $15 million. I think it'd be reasonable to conclude that the first person will relate to his job very differently than the second person. The first person, after a few weeks, will say, "I can't take these idiots anymore." The second person will say, "It's a breeze." The first person will say, "What about the boredom? What about the monotony? What about this unbearable work conditions?" Second person, no problem. Why is that? It has nothing to do with the circumstances. It has everything to do with their hope or their lack of hope. See, we need a hope like this. We need a hope. I would hasten to add that there must be a balance to this hope. It's easy to hope and to have such a hope that is completely unrealistic. The optimism of one's hope is completely not even grounded, anything close to reality. We need a hope that's balanced. A number of years ago, on Super Bowl Sunday, Christopher Reeves, the famous actor who portrayed Superman in a series of movies in the 70s, who fell off a horse and broke his neck and was paralyzed from the neck down, Christopher Reeves appeared in a television commercial during the Super Bowl, walking. The commercial created a huge buzz because it was believed that a cure for paralysis had been discovered, and Christopher Reeves had been healed, and it showed it on this television commercial. Of course, he hadn't actually been cured. He was portrayed to be walking by some slick creative movie editing. Well, a few weeks later, Charles Krauthammer in Time magazine wrote an article criticizing Christopher Reeves for this television commercial. He says, I have been long reluctant to criticize Christopher Reeves. It is not easy attacking someone who has suffered such a devastating injury and has carried on with such spirit. Christopher Reeves had told Good Morning America the day after the commercial had aired. He said this, the biggest problem actually is people who have been in a chair for a very long time because in order to survive psychologically, they've had to accept their paralysis. They've had to say, okay, I'm going to spend the rest of my life in a wheelchair. Reeves said that it was wrong for him to accept his paralysis. His only hope, which enabled him to continue to live, was the absolute confidence that medical science would find a cure for him within his own lifetime. Now, the man who wrote this criticism, Charles Krauthammer, was himself confined to a wheelchair. He had had a spinal cord injury when he was 22 years old. He was confined to a wheelchair ever since. He also, by the way, is an MD. He says, Reeves' propaganda to that effect undermines those who are struggling to face reality, to master it, and to make a life for themselves from their wheelchairs. But Reeves' belief, this man says, is that people in wheelchairs don't dream enough about getting out of them. Krauthammer says, on the contrary, the problem is that they dream too much about it. He says, when I was injured, I had a roommate in my four-bed ward, who was making no effort to continue his education or plan for a new career from his wheelchair. One day he told me why. He said, I'm going to wait for 7 years for a cure. Then, if there's none, I'm going to kill myself. And this is what he says, he concludes. The false optimism Reeve is peddling is psychologically harmful. Such persons can have jobs and lives and careers, but they'll need to work very hard at it. They need to start with precisely the psychological acceptance of reality that Reeve is so determined to undermine. Now, who's right? Who's right? See, that's not really mine to give, although I have experienced some of this kind of, super high degree of optimism. Yes, we're going to get well. Yes, we're going to get out of this. See, there are two different points of view. One is the unrealistic optimism, and the other is pessimism. One person accuses the other, your hope is too pessimistic. One person accuses the other, no, your hope is too unrealistic. See, what I'm commending to you to this morning is a hope that is both and neither. A hope that is optimistic enough and one that is realistic enough. We need a hope that has power to sustain the sufferer in his suffering. Even if that suffering hardly will ever go away. Where is that hope to be found? Is there hope Is there such a hope that can not deny the reality of the tragedy of your experience, but also encouraging, emboldening, fortifying? Not necessarily promise that God's promise in Jesus is that you're never going to suffer. That is not what the Bible promises. But the Bible promises real hope. Well, let me just observe a second point here, that there is such a hope. John is writing this book to a bunch of people who were about to suffer, and to suffer immensely. It is a triple fact of history that Christians suffered immensely in the first century, and this book of Revelation, is what actually worked to give them hope. When persecutions came upon Christians in the first century, Christians sang. When persecution came upon Christians in the first century, they prayed for the people killing them. It worked. When plagues came, and there were many in the first early centuries of the church, many people fled the city to get away from the contagion, but Christians remained. Christians continued to minister to people. Christians risked their lives, and many of them did get the contagion and did die serving people. Serving their family, serving friends, serving believers, serving unbelievers. They had a hope. This hope fortified them. They had a no problem sort of attitude. It is not that they didn't, it's not that they thought dying would be fine or seeing their kids tortured would be okay. No. Revelation says there were tears. There was mourning. There was heartbreak. Christians experienced this, and it was for real. But there was also a hope. Something greater than $15 million. They had a hope that enabled them to face what they were facing, and to face it with confidence. You need that today? Well, let's look at this passage now. I'm going to give three subpoints in this third point. What is this living hope? Three subpoints that will form the rest of this sermon for the most part. There is one last point which will wrap up in just a few minutes, but the rest of this will be fleshing out what this passage says about hope for us. Three descriptions of this living hope. First of all, let me give you subpoint A. I'm following the outline here. This hope is an already and not yet hope. This hope is an already and not yet hope. Notice verse 4. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain. Here this verse is talking about a hope that is in the future. It is a not yet. These Christians are going to experience tears, death, mourning, crying, and pain. But he says there will be a time when that will no longer be. This hope is a future hope. But let me also observe, it is a present hope as well. Notice 21 verse 5, he who was seated on the throne said, I am making all things new. Something already, I am making all things new, and something not yet, I will wipe away every tear. Now how is this to be the case? How is it already and it not yet? And how can it make the difference? Well, notice in verse 3 and verse 5, 21:3 and verse 5, these two words are being used here. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, and then in verse 5, he who was seated on the throne said. The way in which we can begin to get this experience of hope is by coming to the throne. This reminds me of the part in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And then if you've either read the book or seen the movie, or both, and these four children discover what is a kind of magical world through this wardrobe, the world of Narnia, and Narnia is a place where it is always winter but never Christmas, because of the stranglehold of the Queen of Narnia, which is really the White Witch, which is the devil character in this metaphor. And then, all of a sudden, these kids are traveling, and they happen upon Father Christmas. Father Christmas appears and In the book, he says, Aslan is on the move. In the movie, you see this, ooh, you feel it overcoming you. Aslan is on the move. And what he's saying is that the white witch's stranglehold is beginning to weaken. But that's true, everyone. We've all experienced that. But Jacob gave a testimony of how the stranglehold of the devil is weakened. He who blinded the eyes of the world, it's hard to weaken. We are testimony of that. That the resurrection is already beginning to take place. We who have, since we have been raised with Christ, even before the resurrection, it's happening already. See, if you would have this hope, the hope that defies hardship, the hope that sustains you in hardship, you must come to the throne. The degree to which you bring yourself to the Lordship of Christ is the degree to which you'll find more and more of this healing. Chapter 22, verse 2 says, the leaves of the tree of life are for the healing of the nations. The degree to which you bring your marriage to the Lordship of Christ will be the degree to which you begin to discover more of this healing. Don't we need that for ourselves? We should think that this Christian hope is someplace in between pessimism and optimism at all. Let's consider another story, another wheelchair story, but not the same people I mentioned earlier. Consider two guys in a wheelchair. One of the guys could say, pessimistically, I'm never going to walk again. There's no hope for me. I'm forever bound in this chair. But let me just make an observation about that statement. You might say that life is over for me, and I'm never going to, and things are really, really bad for me, but I think the gospel needs to be pressed upon even someone like that, and the gospel needs to impress upon him that he is actually even worse off than he realizes. His body is actually more broken than his paralysis left on. His soul is broken. His soul is ruined. The gospel says we're worse off than we appear. Even if we were able to have all of our faculties, our soul is broken. In fact, our soul is so bad, it is so broken, that it required the breaking of the Son of God for us to be made whole. Here's the application. If Jesus is broken for you, if Jesus is broken for you, and he was, then could you not endure some measure of brokenness for him, even if it is temporary? The gospel hope is also more optimistic than human hope. The gospel hope says, I know I will walk again, but more. Isaiah chapter 40 says, not only shall we walk and not faint, not only shall we run and not grow weary, the prophet says, we shall soar. The biblical gospel hope is more realistic than human pessimism. It is more optimistic than human optimism. You say, I know I will be healed in this life. Optimism. Or, I know I'll never be healed in this life. Pessimism. Or, let's apply it this way. Let's say that you're single and you want to be married. You think, I'm never going to get married. Or I know one day I am going to get married. Well, let me just apply it this way. Let's say your marriage is not doing very well. You say, he is never going to love me. She is never going to love me. Or, I absolutely know one day things are going to turn around. Well, let me just make an observation about each of those statements. I guess I would want to say that each of those statements doesn't have a high enough ambition. For each of these statements has a hope that's found only in this present life. The gospel says our hope is take us to beyond. A hope that will satisfy us beyond all of our imagination. The gospel says to you, yes, your spouse may be disinterested in you, but Jesus Christ experienced utter disinterest on the cross. Yes, your life, your physical body might be broken, and you might feel alone, but Jesus Christ experienced utter aloneness on the cross. Could you then not as a matter of discipleship, receive this station in life for His sake and to endure for His sake. And already and not yet hope. Let me make another observation here. It's an urban world. Chapter 21, verse 2, I saw a holy city, a new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven. It's an urban hope. Our future begins in a garden and ends in a city. One of the images of heaven often that we use is going up to heaven. But here the Bible says heaven is coming down. The heaven of the new heavens and the new earth is when heaven and earth merge, where we'll live on earth, the new earth, in the presence of God forever. I would have to add, notice in chapter 22, verse 20, the angel showed me the river of the water of life, clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and from the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. Here on the one hand, there's a city, and there's a little bit of country mixed in here. I know that for many of you who have found, they've ever come from an urban setting, my wife has lived in San Francisco her whole life. She likes living in an urban area. I've only visited San Francisco before. I never want to live there. For lots of reasons, but mainly because there's just no place to live. I mean, the houses on 24th Avenue are this far apart. There's actually no side yard. I was living in Highlands Ranch. You know, there's like 3 feet between the side of the house and your fence, and you could reach over and borrow the neighbor's salt from your kitchen table and put it back. It's so close. But in San Francisco, it's this short space. If a house has any yard, it's in the backyard. And when you go out during the day, you're surrounded by people everywhere. Now, to me, I can tolerate that for a little bit of time. People who have grown up in the city love it. I find suburbia even a little bit confined myself. But the Bible depicts the new heavens and the new earth as a city. Not as a farm, not as a suburban area, but as a city. And I have to imagine that one of the reasons is because of what the grace of God does in fact require of us. You know, when you live in close proximity to other people, now you've had roommates before, or you've had a family visiting you in the past, and you all of a sudden have an increase of people in your home, and your home was already small enough as it is, and then you have 3 or 4 other people in your room using the same facilities and so forth, and you start stepping on each other, get a little impatient. And I would submit to you that in a city-like environment, the grace of God is an absolute necessity. You know, as we begin to think strategically, and even in terms of values, of having an outreach in this community, we're going to have to learn how to enjoy being patient, being forbearing, being tolerant of people, people that are not like us, as people want to find out what Skype is about, and they start coming. Perhaps the smallness of our church will change, and we're going to have to grow in patience, grow in forbearance, as more and more people press upon us, as more and more people want things from us, as we start having to serve people when we're already tired. I have to imagine that's what it's like to live in a city. In a city where every tribe, nation, tongue, and people are all kind of thrown together, it's very different than living in a suburban area where most suburban people live, and people live, there tends to be a kind of a harmony of opinion, much more so in a rural area or suburban area than in a city. People in a city who come from all kinds of different experiences have different experiences, perspectives, history, priorities, which clash with yours. Makes it a perfect place to experience and a need for the graciousness of God. What a place for the grace of God to flourish. It must flourish there. If it succeeds there, it can succeed anywhere. See, what should our priorities as a church be? It should be as what is described here in these verses, where it says that God will wipe away the tears from their eyes. I think that says something about what a church is to be. The church isn't just about the business of preaching the gospel, as central and as foundational as that is, but it's about reaching people who are hurting, who have tears, who are mourning, who experience death, and who feel the gracious kindness and mercy of God. That's the goal. Well, third nuance here. Not only is it a hope that is already and not yet, not only is it an urban hope, it's also a bridal hope. The holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. You might say, and I've heard this before, the bride of Christ image. Yes, but let me just press this image on you a little bit for a few more minutes. Consider first the dress. Now, when a woman is about to get married, for the most part, every dress needs to have its own uniqueness to express the uniqueness of the woman wearing it. But for the most part, wedding dresses are the same. They are beautifully adorned, and they cover. That's basically what a dress does. Can you imagine what it would be if a woman were to walk down the aisle wearing a bikini, where all of her physical body would be exposed? You would discern if she had prepared herself for the wedding or not. You would discern if she generally is health conscious or not. All of her imperfections would be visible. All of the things that you would see of her physique would be visible. There's a good reason why there is a wedding dress. In order to adorn her body. And in many ways, it resembles what Christ has done for us in covering us with his righteousness. Let me press this a little further. Let's talk about the person underneath the dress. Consider the bride. Now, I'm not just picking on women here. Because in the Bible tells us in the book of Hosea, when the prophet is instructed by God to go and marry a woman named Gomer. Now, if you're familiar with this story, Gomer was a prostitute. Hosea, the prophet, was instructed by God to go and marry Gomer, the prostitute. It's really a metaphor. God is being depicted by Hosea. Israel and the church is being depicted by the prostitute. We are that prostitute, friends. I'm looking into a series of lectures on Martin Luther right now, and this lecture says Martin Luther loved this metaphor. He loved the metaphor of the prostitute. Because Luther said the gospel is the King of Kings giving his son in marriage, but the woman to whom he is giving his son is a prostitute, just like the Gomer and Hosea image. We are that prostitute. And because of the marriage to the king's son, we become the bride. You see, that changes everything. We are no longer what we used to be because of the vow. The language of the vow of God that the son makes to his bride. The woman gets betrothed to the king's son. She gets cleaned up. She wears beautiful wedding clothes. She gets all the wealth of the king's son. And of course, her responsibility is to distribute that wealth to the world. Think of it. When the prophet hears the wedding vow from the king's son and she believes it, that changes her. She is no longer what she was. She is no longer a prostitute. She is now glorious. She is now royalty. She is now a queen. You see, part of the Christian experience is to remind yourself of who you are based on the vow the son made to his bride. See, who are you? Who are you? You who have believed the vow that God made to you in His Son,
You aren't what you used to be. And for you to tell yourself that is an insult to the Lord. If you customarily beat yourself up and say, "You loser. You filth." That not only is not true, it's an insult to the Lord. You need to stop saying that. You need to start believing what His Word has done to you. What His promise to marry you does to you. You aren't your old self anymore. You are now to believe what Christ says about you. That you are King. That you are His beloved. And you are His. You, because of the Son, not only receive all that the Son is, but all that the Son possesses. You receive His gifts. His gifts of righteousness. His gifts of justice. Sanctification. Holiness. Blessedness. But that is only secondary, because the real gift is getting Him. The real gift is not getting all the stuff God has stored up for you. The real gift is getting God. But in this marriage as well, all that is His becomes mine, but all that is yours becomes His. Luther called this the great exchange. That which is associated with being a prostitute, sin, death, hell, devil, gets transferred onto Jesus. He gladly takes off her debts and pays it in full with His suffering and death on the cross. Notice it's the one who sits on the throne, the Lamb. The King's Son is a Lamb. Here Luther says, on the cross God engaged in a mighty duel. This author says, Luther loves battles. He says in his great hymn, "Dost ask who that may be? Christ Jesus is He. Lord Sabaoth His name, from age to age the same. He must win the battle." Jesus wins the battle, but it looks like He is defeated in that, because He dies. But you must remember that it is God incarnate who dies. It is God in His Son Jesus who dies. He defeats death by absorbing death into Himself. And death, therefore, is followed by life. I don't know about you, that is impossible language. A city, a bride, the already and not yet, the urban, the bridal, all this imagery. Here's another one. This is from Martin Luther. He said, "As little children in their womb know about their own birth, so little do we know about life everlasting." Now think about that. I can't remember that far back. I doubt anyone can. See, in many ways, how can a person who was born and raised in a garden know what it's like to live in a city? How can anybody who is single and never been married know what it's really like to be married? It's not until you actually cross over and discover can you really know. And I think this is also the case with everlasting life. See, why is this imagery here? Why is the imagery here? And this is the last part. How to get this hope. I think this imagery here is here because is designed to be so dense that it requires us to meditate, to grapple with, so that it can captivate us. A city in a dress, the already and not yet, the urban, the bridal, and many other metaphors, the river of life flowing down the middle of the city, because it's not easy for us to completely fathom what that is about. You see, this in fact did work. The people of God who considered this language from Revelation actually were able to sustain the worst kind of torture. To do so with joy. To do so with gladness. Let me conclude by asking this question. What is your adversity today? Have you come into this room today feeling a need for hope? Is your situation hopeless to you? Well, you came to the right person. Not me. You came to Jesus Christ, who is risen from the dead today. I want to encourage you to trust in Him. If you're visiting for the first time, and maybe you're here and you've never believed in Jesus before, I invite you today to believe in Him. I invite you to trust in Him. To trust in the One who not only died, but rose the third day. And not only rose the third day, but ascended and is seated and is reigning on high and is willing to offer you every hope you need. Another thing I want to say is, remember where He is seated on the throne. You must come to Him and you must submit yourself to Him. You must be willing to say to Him, I give you my heart, I give you my life, I give you my entire everything. Do with me whatever you wish. But thirdly, let me also encourage you. Let your mind explode with this imagery. And expect this imagery to change you. This hope gave Christians throughout all the ages confidence when they needed to face what was going to crush them. This gave them what they needed. It'll give you the same. That's right. Father in heaven, we thank you for the hope of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. For this morning, we wish to give you our hearts afresh this morning. We're thankful for the imagery here in Revelation that depicts something of what we are to experience, and as best as we are able, we see a few slivers of grass coming up through the ground of what the final resurrection will be like. Lord, but we're not there yet. And so we need hope now. So I pray for the people of God here in this room today. That you'll supply them with hope. You'll embolden them. You'll enable them to find hope where presently there is none. And that this hope not only will sustain, but will empower them to serve those who insult them, to love their enemies, to do good to those who hate them, to bless those who curse, and to pray for those who misuse. We thank you that this is the promise that we have in Jesus Christ, that His resurrection is already beginning in us. May that be realized even this afternoon. And so we wish to trust in you. Help our unbelief. And as much as we are humanly able to grapple with these promises, make them true and real in our lives. For Jesus' sake.